Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24, the very first of the year. We're asking what lies ahead in 2018.
Luckily, Tom, we've assembled a crack team to try and work that out. We'll be hearing about what's on the agenda in Japan, Asia and beyond with our Tokyo bureau chief, Fiona Wilson.
We'll also be looking to the United States and discussing whether 2018 has potential to be a year to remember in US politics, rather than the one we've all been trying to forget. Charles McFarlane from our New York bureau will be here in the studio.
We'll also, Tom, be looking north to Canada. Thomas Lewis, Monocle's Toronto bureau chief, will join us.
Plus, we'll play some great music from some of those places. All that ahead here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. So, Henry, here we are, the first weekly of 2018. I must ask you, how did you spend Christmas and the New Year? I imagine drinking yourself insensible.
Probably in a similar way to you, Tom, not drinking myself insensible, but instead with my young family. The difference, of course, being that we're on different sides of the generational divide. Me still on the children's table, you getting older. What did you do specifically?
Yeah, very nice. With the in-laws here in London town, not too far flung.
Mm-hmm.
Positively Dickensian, I
cheeses?
Felt. Lot of cheese, you can probably tell.
Give me some specifics.
I'm carrying a lot of it sort of in the neck region.
Indeed.
Yeah. Did you, so you mentioned no drinking excesses, which I find hard to believe.
No.
In culinary terms, turkey, sprouts, what was your poison?
We have quite a vegetarian family, a majority in fact, so nut roasts.
Oh,
were in demand.
Very questionable.
I know you think that's...
I may throw that open to the rest of the panel later when they join
us. I'd be interested to hear their opinions.
I imagine they'll be quite derisive. And look, we're going to be talking about what the year holds in store. Do you have any personal, I don't know, pledges? Are you undertaking...
Pledges?
Are you undertaking any New Year's...
Like I'm joining a cult or something?
Resolutions, for example, Henry. I have a few I can suggest for you.
Please.
If you're in the market. Well, no. Tell me what's on your agenda.
I feel that I initiated some healthy habits toward the end of last year, which I hope to continue, but I'm not...
Go on.
I'm not initiating in the new year. And I think that is going to enable me to stick to them. Rock climbing. Started doing a sport. I've told you about this. Indoors, granted. Yeah. But nonetheless, I've been enjoying that activity. Haven't got on with sports or physical activity generally in my life.
Those who are familiar with Henry will probably be able to imagine why. So lots more bouldering from you coming up in 2018.
Indeed. What would you recommend? What would you prescribe to me, Tom?
What resolutions wise? Yes. Why don't we talk about this off air after the programme?
Okay.
I'll let the listeners' imagination run riot with that one, Henry. That's how we spent Christmas and a little bit about what's in store for 2018. But let's find out what the world can be looking forward to in what's sure to be a very busy and dynamic next 12 months.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Henry Rhys-Sheridan, and Tom Edwards.
To kick things off, we're joined by Fiona Wilson, Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief, and we also have Charles McFarlane here from our New York outpost and Thomas Lewis from Toronto. More from the latter two in just a moment. But Fiona, welcome. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
It's a delight that you're one of the first faces I see in the new year. 2018 in your neck of the woods, and we can talk about this from an intensely personal viewpoint, but also big picture stuff. It's a region that's very much been in the spotlight for good and bad. What are some of the headlines that you think that will be unfolding? What are you going to be watching from your Tokyo posting?
I mean, you wouldn't really need to get a crystal ball out to know that North Korea will be featuring rather heavily.
Is that
heavily.
Going to be cropping up again?
Yeah. Possibly, yes. I think probably imminently. It's just inevitable. Completely dominated last year's headlines for various reasons, as did Donald Trump, I have to say. Although he's not in the region, he is always talking about the region. Actually, he did visit the region last year. Occasionally, hilariously, there were some quite spectacular gaffes, of course. But yeah, you know, what he says about Asia has a huge impact, and what he says about North Korea. And it's been a roller coaster. I mean, he veers between saying he'll talk to Kim Jong-un to saying he's going to annihilate North Korea. So that really kind of controls the narrative. So in fact, from our point of view, we're thinking, let's hope Donald Trump can manage his tweets.
Fiona, I'm interested. Is coverage of that type of thing in the region as kind of doomy as it's been in the West? Or has proximity to the actors involved, the issues at stake, bred a more kind of pragmatic analysis?
That's so interesting because, I mean, obviously, you know, there were various missiles being lobbed from North Korea. Very close to Japan. I mean, actually in Japanese waters. And people were calling me up from London saying, are you okay? You know, and obviously here we were talking about the baseball results or in Japan. I mean, people are really, I think pragmatic is a good way of putting it. North Korea's been troubled for years. Of course, it stepped up a lot last year. But no, I think the perspective is very different now. I mean, the Japanese government, Shinzo Abe, definitely likes to play it up as much as possible. It suits his agenda. It suits his desire to rewrite the constitution, ramp up the military. And if you think, oh, you've got this threatening neighbour, it all makes more sense. And I think whenever these missiles got thrown up, you know, the J alert system, which is when your mobile phone goes crazy when anything's about to happen, they talked about that a lot last year. And it really kind of kicked into action. And, you know, actually, in the office, in the Monocle Bureau, I'd have to say to people, anyone feeling anything about the latest missile? People don't even, not they don't notice, but it's not quite as dangerous. It doesn't really affect daily lives as much as you'd think.
I like to hear about how remarkably sanguine our colleagues are over in the Bureau. And just that point that Henry raised there, Fiona, about the stakeholders in this. Of course, you've got, you know, the two key actors on the Korean Peninsula itself, China to the north, Japan, where you're sitting. Is there a feeling that in 2018, the resolutions, such as they may be, are to be found within that theatre? Or is there this sense that, whether we like it or not, we do have to factor in the view from Washington and the role of the what did you call him, tweeter-in-chief?
I mean, Japan always has to factor in the US because Japan's defence depends on the US. So absolutely. But, you know, China, obviously the other absolutely critical player. And I mean, there's so much analysis of what's happening in North Korea. And, you know, you probably noted at the end of last year, it was being reported that camps are being built along that border with China, you know, in anticipation of refugees. And that's always been a big discussion, that China is very keen that North Korea doesn't collapse because there are going to be millions of refugees heading north. Plus, you'd have a friendly South Korea, US-friendly South Korea, a bit too close. So, you know, many reasons why China is critical. I think a lot of people felt that it had more influence over Kim Jong-un. It could actually say, tell Kim Jong-un, you can't do this or you can. And I think last year we really saw that they couldn't, actually.
So we've got a looser cannon yet in Pyongyang, which is slightly alarming.
Yeah, I mean, I've often thought, though, that, you know, really what he's been doing is very logical. Looked at from the North Korean perspective, they feel under threat. Donald Trump is threatening to annihilate them. You might feel a little bit defensive. And in fact, you know, developing a missile program was very, very sane and very logical.
Well, it's expedient from the North Korean viewpoint, and it's also expedient existentially from the Chinese viewpoint for precisely that reason you mentioned about the South. Charles McFarlane from our New York Bureau, just from that US role here, any sense that in 2018, Donald Trump or whomsoever in his inner circle may develop not an advanced, nuanced view and an advanced, nuanced foreign policy, but a slightly more pragmatic or informed view on this? Or are you certainly individually primed for more of the same?
I'm definitely primed for more of the same. I don't think the word nuance could even enter the conversation. But I do think sort of a gross miscalculation by the U.S. has always been thinking that someone could pull strings with North Korea, either be it, you know, sort of now the Chinese or, you know, even before that, maybe even the Russian government sort of during that time period. And we've seen this year that that's not the case at all, that we have to deal with this actor sort of one-on-one. And I'm not feeling very confident about who's having that conversation.
I don't think, Charles, you're alone in that. Fiona, let's maybe switch our sights to something else. And I was going to say something more optimistic, but you tell me. Winter Olympics, is this a happy, smiley story, the antidote to the Korean goings-on? Or is there a sort of dark underbelly to this one as well?
I mean, there always is. It seems very gloomy, doesn't it? I mean, I feel a bit sorry, to be honest, for the South Koreans with this Winter Olympics. I mean, it's coming up in a few weeks and it's just all been bad news. I mean, you know, between North Korea, what's happening there is obviously hanging over the whole thing. But also, you know, Nikki Haley, you know, US ambassador to the United Nations, very casually said, oh, we might not send the US athletes. And I heard that, you know, Well, I heard that, you know, US diplomats were slightly in despair about this in South Korea. And also it was very discouraging for the South Koreans. So I think the feeling is there's not much interest in the Winter Olympics. I think there was much interest in the Sochi Olympics, and it's kind of gone down from there, to be honest.
Well, I think one thing that's interesting is, kind of geopolitics aside, I think since they won the Winter Olympics, since they were bidding for it, the prestige of the Olympics as an event has kind of nosedived. And particularly when it comes to bidding for the Summer Olympics, we've seen this remarkable phenomenon of actually them not being able to find enough candidate cities, and cities winning by default because they don't want to take on the responsibility of putting on what has garnered a reputation or as becoming a bit of a white elephant. Do you think there's a little bit of disappointment about that too? Perhaps when they won it, they thought it was going to be a bit more of a ticker tape parade than it's going to turn out to be.
Yeah, I mean, that's so true. And it's interesting in that bit of the world, there is less cynicism about the Olympics, oddly. I mean, obviously, the Russians are not going to be there. That's another bit. That's another sort of a sad thing that's happened. But, you know, Japan's got the Summer Olympics coming up, 2020, and they are still, oh, they're smiling about that. In spite of all the problems, huge amount, the cost of building a new stadium. I think the cynicism is just, it's much less prevalent there. People are still hopeful. But I think the Winter Olympics, there's just a kind of a lack of glamour, isn't there? So who knows? But Japan has got some very good skaters, so they're hopeful. You know, maybe some gold medals there.
Eyes on the ice, perhaps, and see what happens. Fiona, you touched briefly on Shinzo Abe, particularly in the sort of foreign policy space for Japan. Just domestically, what's the sort of key narratives to look out for? Is it about how he sort of attempts to consolidate his position on some of the issues that you mentioned briefly earlier? Is there fresh domestic discord for one reason or another? What should we be tuned into in the 12 months ahead?
I mean, weirdly with Shinzo Abe, you don't find people saying, we love Shinzo Abe, he's so great. It just doesn't happen. People don't love him, but he wins elections and he won an election at the end of last year. Called it a year early and everyone was like, whoa, what's he doing? It looked like there was a challenger, the governor of Tokyo, Koike, but, you know, her party imploded very quickly and he was back in his usual unassailable position. So
he's quite good at politics. Why is he not more I mean, he is popular in terms of the ballot box suggests that he gets results, but he's not popular, as you said. Is there a disconnect there, and what explains that?
Yeah, I mean, there is a huge disconnect. I think one of the big things is he's always going on about security. And for most Japanese people, they don't really want to change the constitution. And when asked, they say, no, thank you. We quite like our pacifist constitution. Please don't change it. But they consistently vote for a party that has made that one of its kind of platforms. So I don't know. It's always hard to understand with Abe. He's very, very confident now. You know, they've got the leadership of the LDP, his party, coming up in September. Of course he's going to win. And, you know, he's really looking at being the longest serving Japanese prime minister since the war. So, I mean,
which is remarkable for a man with consistently low approval ratings. I think that's a disconnect you were pointing to, Tom. He's kind of, by hook or by crook, finessed, I suppose, the state of Japanese politics.
Well, I wonder, is he like some other global leaders, we can talk a bit more about this later in the programme, who are kind of the best available? You know, there aren't the sort of dashing young blades out there who understand how to galvanise popular support but also be efficient politicians. It's a safe pair of hands.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, safe pair of hands is so important. You know, these are difficult, unstable times with North Korea, and people just think, let's just vote to the LDP, who they've pretty much voted in consistently since the war. And the opposition has collapsed. I mean, it's a real failure of the opposition in Japan. You know, Shinzo Abe's government, as we keep saying, is not, like, personally very popular, but who else are people going to vote for? That's the feeling at the moment. And just before the last election, the opposition really did just sort of seed the whole thing.
Why? What are the wedge issues between the parties in Japan? Because I actually have no idea.
Well, it turned out there were very few issues between Koike, who set up her own party, the governor of Tokyo. She set up her own party just before the election. Very quick sort of burst of popularity. There was very little to separate her and Shinzo Abe. They come from the same political background, centre-right. There was almost nothing to separate them apart from nuclear power. She came out, you know, against nuclear power. She's for changing the constitution. And actually what people realised is, well, why would we vote for her then? Because pretty much it's the same story. And I just think there's no credible opposition at the moment. And, if you ask why, the opposition party was a compromise job. It pulled together people from all bits of the political spectrum. And naturally, they didn't really have a consistent message. They didn't know we were going to get, what kind of economy was it going to be? Are we having nuclear power? And I think for the electorate, they just thought, oh, we don't know. Well, we know what Shinzo Abe stands for, and he's pretty good on the economy, or he seems to be. You know, that's the impression he gives, and so they just largely voted for him. Low turnout, though. There's no love there.
Well, it's been, and which in itself speaks volumes. Fiona, always good to hear from you. That's our Fiona Wilson. We'll be hearing from more of our Bureau staff after this. A bit of a focus on New York and the United States next. Now, before we move on, let's have some tunes. We're kind of following our global chat with some global records, Henry. This is new from American record label Light in the Attic. They specialise in lost sounds, rediscovered and breathed life into anew. They have a new compilation of Japanese music, and given we were just in that part of the world, let's hear some of it. The compilation is Even a Tree Can Shed Tears, Japanese Folk and Rock, 1969 to 1973... Fiona Wilson, I'm guessing you're going to be well versed in these tracks, not because of the era, you understand, but because it's very specialist. We've got Kazuhiko Kato to hear, which we'll play in a second. A favourite of yours?
Yeah, I'm not actually that familiar with Kato Sanzo. Looking forward to getting to know it though.
Okay, well maybe you can cue this one in for us. Here is Kato San, and the track, Fiona, is
it's called Arthur Hakase no Jinriki Hikoki.
Kazuhiko Kato there. I thought that was pretty good, Fiona. It's kind of a bit sort of moodier and a bit kind of darker than I was expecting. I like it.
Yeah, we'll be having that on in the office.
Well,
who's the titular Arthur? That's what I want to know.
I'm longing to find out. I shall be doing a bit of research.
Exactly. We can get on the article. What about Charles? Will you play that in the New York Bureau, maybe?
Oh, most definitely.
Pretty good, right? Yeah. You're kind of getting into
a little
that,
bit of Americana vibes, too.
Definitely. Yeah. Well, speaking of which, let's turn our attentions to the US of A. The nation has no small amount of influence over the whole world. Still, perhaps surprisingly, as we've already been discussing, here to answer on its behalf, the appointed spokesman, Charles McFarlane, of your state, from our New York Bureau. Being serious for a moment, I do find it difficult. What's on the collective agenda into 2018? I guess it's how to deal with Trump. I'm loathe to keep talking about him, but he's the inescapable face of the nation, at least for the time being.
Yeah, as long as he still has two thumbs to tweet with, he seems to sort of be definitely taking up the news. Mm. I mean, we saw sort of at the end of last year, sort of the Alabama Senate race go in a, I will say, I was a little surprised, which maybe is saying something, that a Democrat won their first time in about 25 years. But yeah, I mean, it remains to be seen sort of if the Democrats can really get it together for this year, for the midterms that are coming up in November. I think we should definitely take note of the one special election that they did win, who his competition was.
Well, it's so tantalizing, isn't it, for them, because there must be such an urge to interpret that as a roadmap for how they might succeed more broadly. But then, as you mentioned, it was a special election, not only in name, but under exceptional circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, if we're looking at it that way, the roadmap is, you know, have a, you know, be running against a Republican that's accused of crimes. I mean, that's
well, it
really
didn't work
what
for
it
the
is.
Last time, did it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that seems to really be sort of all they have going on in Alabama, and it paid off, which I think we should all sort of take note of. Also, you know, that you saw a lot of African-American voters and a lot of women sort of coming to the polls that have been facing a lot of problems getting to the polls, especially in places like Alabama, that they were able to overcome that.
Well, I think that would be the lesson to take away from it, wouldn't it? I think there was a 95% black vote for Doug Jones, the Democratic candidate, and that was off the back of a remarkable mobilization effort. So I imagine that is something which they will be able to apply in the future. Not that they haven't already been trying to get the vote out among minority communities who are disproportionately Democrat so far, but
yeah, I think so. And I think that, you know, sort of just the level of voter suppression, especially in the South, and you were able to sort of see that sort of, I guess, not go away by any sort of stretch, but sort of be overcome.
Charles mentioned it. We were talking to Fiona a little earlier about the paucity of credible candidates to stand in opposition. Now, obviously, the Democrats, you obviously have the sort of midterms where the dynamic's a bit different. But even if we look nationwide, one of the narratives we've had actually since Trump was returned to office was, well, you know, post-Hillary, what is left? Is there a unity candidate, someone who could sort of galvanise the, I was going to say the sort of American left, but it's really the American centre, even the centre-right, you could argue. No one yet, really. No one leaps out. And you don't get the sense that there's somebody to sort of really rally around. Does this remain a problem into 2018 for the whole of the Democrat movement?
I do think that most people who are looking forward to 2020 are sort of trying to hang back. And you sort of see this already happening with the Democratic leadership, you know, with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. They don't really come out that much sort of against Trump. They're trying to sort of hang back and not create too much noise now and then sort of in 2020 ramp it up. But probably closer to 2019. But I think for now, people are trying to bite their time and not sort of present a target for Trump's tweets.
Well, on that point about Trump, I did want to ask a bit about media, because there's been some interesting impacts knock-on from Trump's success. Of course, there's been a lot of talk about fake news and this kind of thing. But we've seen readers, listeners, viewers kind of returning to heritage media brands, which I guess is a positive, if we can find one. What's the role, in your view, the media needs to play this year? Is it about holding Trump to account? Is it about the media itself being a bit savvier, being a bit smarter, sharper with the way that it prosecutes its trade?
Yeah, I'd say I think there's been a lot of focus, especially sort of with the Russia investigation, of getting there first and maybe sometimes not always getting it right, unfortunately. Of course, you know, sort of outlets like CNN and the New York Times, they correct, you know, a story when it's wrong, but it's just creating so much fodder for, you know, Trump and his followers who say don't trust the media, when you have outlets like ABC and CNN, CBS having to walk back stories only hours after sort of going out with them. And you saw that, especially in December, that's starting to happen more and more. And I think, you know, if they should sort of be looking forward to anything, it's maybe hang back, try to get it right, and not maybe be the first one there.
It's interesting. Yeah, I think if there is going to be a new model for being able to combine the fairly treacherous financial landscape that, or business landscape rather, that media organizations face with kind of a fidelity to the founding principles of journalism and producing good work, it's going to happen in America simply because the market there is so big, the economy is so large that, you know, if an organization is going to come up with a successful model, it's going to be there, and hopefully other places around the world can imitate it. But who for you stands out in your mind as organizations or even individuals who have been approaching it in the right way?
As far as organizations, I'd say, I mean, sort of it's a little bit of a broken record at this point, but I think the Washington Post and the New York Times, I mean, they're reporting in the past year, it's really just been the two of them slugging it out for headlines every day. And, you know, I think you can talk to, you know, our bureau chief, Ed, as well. You know, many times, you know, we're winding down the day at 5 p.m. and we're bombarded with notifications from both of these outlets. And, you know, we're sort of jumping on the radio right away because that's when they're sort of hitting everybody with these breaking stories. It's always around 5, 6 p.m. And there's times when people don't want to go home and they don't want to go down the subway and lose connection because you come up and the world's completely changed the landscape.
I'm just drafting a quick email to Tyler and Andrew about the fact that you wind your day down at 5 p.m. But that's another story. What about you? You painted a nice picture though, of you and Ed enjoying an agreeable afternoon drink. I don't know what you get up to in the New York bureau. No, in all seriousness, what about closer to home in NYC itself? I know it's not all big picture and doom and gloom around Donald Trump. You guys get out and about. You visit lots of great businesses. You keep your ear to the ground. What are you looking forward to in 2018 on your patch?
Maybe not looking forward to, but sort of keeping an eye on would definitely be sort of the state of retail in the U.S., which has been sort of quite a problem, and I'm well reported here on sort of Monocle 24, but sort of a new term was coined this year, retail apocalypse, which now has its own Wikipedia entry for sort of the falling state of retail, malls laying completely barren across sort of the heartland.
Tom, how do you feel about that particular neologism there? Retail apocalypse. Well, one word.
No, two words. Retail apocalypse.
Oh, okay. I thought they were aligned.
That would be smarter.
Would it? I'm not convinced.
I think as long as we avoid it. Fiona Wilson, where are you on the sort of portmanteau spectrum? You know, even just Brexit upsets me to a degree.
It's the burning question that our listeners have been writing about. Fiona Wilson, portmanteaus.
Discuss.
They they do it in Japan as well, though. They put words together. And Instabay was one of the sort of buzzwords of the year, which was, you know, the making yourself look good for an Instagram photo. You have to sort of say it aloud. You read it, you think, what the heck is that? And then you realise once you say it aloud, it does kind of make sense.
We've approached that from a strange direction, Charles. But what is the view? So, I mean, presumably our view is, look, OK, you can talk a good game about retail apocalypse, but actually there are still lots of good news stories. And maybe it's smaller players who are focused on that bricks and mortar story with a bit more vigour, who are bucking the trends you're talking
and
about.
When you see the shops that are closing down, it's mostly these big box stores that have sort of just been completely laden with debt and sort of really can't afford to have that kind of, you know, real estate anymore. But I think in 2018, I'm looking forward to maybe some more smaller shops opening, very much more geared towards, you know, personalization, more pop-ups, and sort of changing the model of how you do retail. I know we'll be there covering that.
And what about for you? Where are we dispatching you to report? What are we getting you to do? Are you looking forward to things, dreading particular things? And you know that we like to try and, if possible, find ways to, new and improved ways to humiliate and challenge our far-flung correspondents, wherever they may be.
I'd like to come back here some more as well.
I'm hearing that's not happening. No, I'm joking, of course. But what else? What's exciting? I mean, are there any things you're particularly looking forward to? What about testing yourself? What are the challenges ahead, Charles?
Challenges ahead. Well, we have a move coming up, so that will definitely be a challenge.
That's quite exciting, of course.
So
more
on
that.
See what happens.
Watch the space, exactly. You're here.
I mean, there's plenty of space available, so as
indeed.
We just found out.
Maybe we're going to get some kind of audio or video diary from you. That'd be quite fun.
Yeah, we could start doing little, you know, Skype-in sessions. Yeah.
Or you could just wear a GoPro permanently attached to your head for the duration
It'll
of the move.
It'll be running upstairs.
Immersive. And we could just immersive journalism.
Yeah. A 24-hour live feed. I tune into that occasionally.
Yeah, what about in the Asia Bureau, Fiona? Because obviously, a lot of radio stations, even, they have the little cameras, don't they, in the studio, so people can really see behind the curtain, as it were.
Funny thing about a Japanese office, it certainly startled me when I first went to Japan, is that people fall asleep at their desk. And it's not considered weird or rude. You
just
suddenly see them face planted.
I'm drafting another email to Tyler now.
Deliberately?
Deliberately.
Or, okay.
It's like, I'm working so hard, I need just 2 minutes, and then I'm ready to
go.
Henry,
do not get any ideas. But we should say also, it's like the slippers and socks and slippers. Very big where you are. And we haven't yet been able to instigate that here in London. I'd like to.
Yeah, I mean, but you need to all the shops that sell the slippers. I mean, everyone's set up. And also, everyone's got the good socks in Japan. You know, I think you'd be a bit horrified probably if everyone took their shoes off here.
Well, no, actually,
Henry, please don't stop it.
I have to say, Tom, I do think that you already have the sock side of that equation sorted. But
Very committed to my socks.
The
yeah.
slipper infrastructure may pose a problem. That I can see.
Exactly.
Because where are you procuring them from?
I feel we've drifted a long way from the big geopolitical challenges of 2018. But nevertheless, it's been a delight, Fiona and Charles, to talk to you. Now, next up, we are going, a little north from New York City. We're heading to our Toronto bureau, and our bureau chief there is Thomas Lewis, who's jumped in to join us right now. Thomas,
Mr.
welcome.
Mr. Edwards, thank you so much. What a pleasure to be here.
A very happy...
Thanks for the invitation.
Happy New Year to you.
Thomas,
you too.
Why are you only half wearing a coat?
Because it's been a bit of a busy day for me, Henry. As is every day, of course.
But, Twas ever thus. Now, we're going to do a sort of rolling substitution, as if we're like a sports fixture. Fiona, it's been a delight as well. Thanks for guiding us through what 2018 has in store. Do you have anything to say to Thomas Lewis before he sort of takes seizes the mantle from you?
Keep it clean, Fiona.
I'm thinking Thomas looks rather tanned. Have you been somewhere warm for your New Year holidays?
I'm just really hot and bothered, actually.
listeners, if that's ever an image to power you on through 2018, there it is. Fiona, great to speak with you. Thank you. And Thomas, good to have you with us. Now, let's put our sights on your neck of the woods next. We will be talking about Canada in more detail in just a moment, but let's have music from Canada first. To set the scene, if you will, this is new from Halifax, Nova Scotia. It's Mao No with Hand.
Stay.
Canada's Mauno there with Hand. That's from their recent album, Tuning. Thomas, what do you make of that tune?
I rather like that tune. Another fine example of music from Nova Scotia. Halifax is a really great little music city, has been for a long, long time. You should go one day if you're in that neck of the woods.
When you were last there, did you get your old ukulele out? A bit of strumming?
I did.
Great heavens.
It's a thing to behold.
The complaints must have been rolling in.
I haven't been allowed back into Halifax.
I was going to say, banned probably for life, quite rightly. Thomas, we're looking ahead, of course, to 2018. But I guess maybe before we do that, it's worth sort of reflecting on 2017 just briefly, which sort of sets the scene for us. What's been the kind of key things in 2017, and how will they shape what happens in the next 12 months?
Well, I think this notion of the ascendancy of brand Canada has really sort of, you know, had its moment in 2017. It was the country's 150th anniversary, of course, lots of big celebrations across the nation, culminating in Ottawa with this huge, huge music festival. On the 1st of July, on Canada Day, the 150th was interesting because, you know, there were events up and down the country, and Canada is a huge, huge place, which is a very disparate place to many people too, if you live on the West Coast or in Yellowknife or wherever you are. But this counter campaign sort of started to take root, really, I think, at the beginning of the year, which really shifted the focus onto Indigenous communities in Canada and the First Nations. And this protest really sort of really became as potent in many ways as the celebrations themselves. You know, the central argument was as well, we're celebrating 150 years of this nation called Canada, but, you know, inherently that excludes the people who are here before and who have been treated very badly and for much of that 150 years.
Thomas, I'm interested because I think it was in 2015 that the country's Truth and Reconciliation Commission actually labelled the school system that had seen First Nations and Native children removed from their families and forcibly re-educated as a cultural genocide. And I remember that being quite a cathartic moment. Is there a sense that that report kind of catalysed some attention on the issue for a short period of time, but hasn't led to sustained engagement?
Justin Trudeau really made all of this very central to his election campaign in 2015. The report, as you rightly say, was published just before that election that took place in the November. He really tried to change the tone of the conversation, I think. When that report came out, Stephen Harper, who was Prime Minister at the time, he wasn't there for the unveiling. He didn't really sort of make much mention of it. And that left a lot of people thinking, well, this is just another, you know, attempt to sort of nod at the wrongs of the past, but actually real change won't happen. Now, the hopes did shift with Justin Trudeau's election. It's become a millstone for him, though, and there's lots of discontent kind of from many First Nations community towards him. And that marked his 2017. He, of course, made his big speech at the UN General Assembly last September. And instead of sort of tapping into this notion of, you know, Canada being, for many people, this kind of leader now on the world stage for the kind of society that we're seeing sort of ebbing away, I suppose, in lots of ways politically in the US and the UK, he focused on the First Nations issues. And I think for a lot of people in Canada, that was a really interesting decision on his part. You know, a political one, a very potent political one in Canada. We're also looking at the residential school system, you know, implementing the sort of the changes, the apologies, or, you know, shifting the sort of role, I guess, that many First Nations communities play in Canada more broadly, you know, runs concurrently with a very high-profile report that's looking into the historic disappearance and murder of many Indigenous women over many, many years. That has been beset by problems in 2017, that we saw the resignation of two heads of that committee, of that investigation, and Justin Trudeau and the government, I don't think, really have handled it particularly well at all, and they really struggle to try and get the PR game sort of back, if you like, to show that, you know, this is something that they're taking very seriously. Now, there was a cabinet reshuffle, and the First Nation sort of portfolio, if you like, was given much more prominence in the cabinet. Again, we'll kind of have to wait and see in 2018 just what that means sort of in reality, and whether, you know, leaders of First Nations communities, you know, First Nations citizens across Canada feel as though there's any sort of real sort of tangible thing. But, you know, this investigation into the disappearance and murder of many Indigenous women really, again, like you described the Truth and Reconciliation Commission report, this will be a really big flashpoint for Canada, because it really is very dark and, you know, very sort of baffling and bewildering chapter in Canada's recent history that really doesn't have an answer at the moment?
Well, let's look at the next chapter, 2018. You've already described actually a number of the sort of big political, well, domestic political challenges and issues that that Trudeau and, well, and Canada will be talking about and facing. What do we need to know, Thomas, as we look into 2018? What's going to be making the news?
Well, Canada Day on the 1st of July will probably be a big day, if all goes according to plan, because that is the day that Justin Trudeau's government wants to legalise marijuana across the country. Now, if it all goes to plan, and the process of sort of hammering out the law and the economics of this is ongoing, was ongoing right up until the end of last year. Really interesting things actually coming out from a sort of business side. The provinces will have sort of control over, you know, how it's sold, pricing, those kind of things. And also they'll be getting most of the profits from marijuana too. Lots of the provinces are trying to style the sale of this in the way that alcohol is sold in many parts of Canada. So in Ontario, for example, the LCBO is one of the largest government buyers of alcohol anywhere in the world. Lots of talk about, you know, whether there'll be an LCBO style, you know, shop to go and buy sort of weed in and things. You're also looking at lots of industries that are trying to sort of get in early, if you like. So the hydroponics industry, you know, it looks like that will, you know, there'll be a lot of sort of interest there. Could be boom times for them. And we've seen some interesting acquisitions by bigger companies taking up smaller ones, you know, taking a bet basically that, you know, because Canada will be the largest industrialised nation to legalise marijuana across the country, you know, that there is a real sort of economic kind of possibility here for lots of different sectors.
Well, it's interesting because it's one of the key arguments when people talk about deregulation or legalisation of various drugs is this idea that there you have not only quality control, it's safer, but this idea that, you know, there's potentially huge revenues for the state or provinces, whatever the system is. Really interesting, I guess. So there'll be a lot of, as you say, developed countries watching with interest. You know, is this deliverable on that kind of scale? It's an experiment unlike anything we've really seen anywhere before.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, culturally, marijuana in Canada is a very potent thing, you know, no pun intended. But, you know, it's kind of, I think, for many people in Canada, been a no-brainer for many, many years. But it has been this problem of how you make it legal, how you regulate it, how you price it. You know, is it a free-for-all? No, it shouldn't be. I think Canada wants, in this moment that it's in, you know, brand Canada being as potent and as visible as it is now, that, you know, this could be something quite concrete that they can show the rest of the world, well, look, you know, this is something we've made work.
Here's how you do progressive social policy.
For sure.
And it's an interesting counterpoint, actually, to what we were talking about before, these dark chapters and this feeling that it's a country that, although actually quite good at self-reflection, if you compare it with what is south of the border, maybe there are some things that haven't been addressed properly, but this shows the sort of face, actually, interestingly, that Trudeau, I guess, has presented more to the rest of the world.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the marijuana kind of issue, you know, has a very particular context in Canada, which is why I think it's kind of getting it right could really be quite a good moment for them, you know, to show the rest of the world, you know, say if you're in Australia or whatever, that looking at sort of how do we make this a real sort of framework, something viable that, you know, makes money, that reflects the habits, the natures of the, you know, the citizens of within the borders. You know, it could be a real sort of, as you say, really interesting moment, I think.
Will there be any less psychoactive developments in Canada in 2018, Thomas?
Well, a big story, of course, for Canada will be what happens with NAFTA, the negotiations, the renegotiation of the NAFTA treaty. It's been such an interesting thing sitting in Canada watching this unfold. I think, of course, you know, the bluster from the White House has been, you know, this is going to be our way or the highway. But the Canadians and the Mexicans have just played quite an interesting game, I think. They were very early, actually, kind of even before kind of Trump won. They were talking to each other, they were sending delegations to each other's countries, you know, just to sort of prepare and to see kind of, you know, what they could do. Now, Chrystia Freeland, who's the foreign minister in the Canadian government, she has become this very sort of impressive figure in these negotiations, because a lot of the things that the Americans have wanted, they've just basically said, well, no, you can't do it. And I think this realization that actually it's not Canada and Mexico sort of bleeding the US dry. There are so many jobs tied up thanks to Canadian industries, but in the USA and vice versa for Mexico too. A story that sort of developed right at the end of the year was that Canada said that they would actually look, if NAFTA is thrown out the window by the US, that they would be happy to look at a one-on-one trade deal with for the United States. Now, that was kind of a, there was a sense in the commentary in the press in Canada that, well, you know, was this the Canadian government throwing Mexico into the bus, for example? It's like, oh, well, sorry, if it doesn't go well, we'll just do our own deal, basically. Mm. It's such a tightrope dealing with the Trump administration. You know, they want to sort of obviously keep on board. They're still the biggest economic trading partners for Canada, at least. But I think Canada is not going to, I don't think, totally abandon, you know, its trades, its trading relationship with Mexico, because it's just too valuable, basically.
Well, and also there's so many big corporations. I mean, you know, and if we look to the US, I mean, Trump always talks about his business savvy, and, you know, we can pontificate all day about whether he actually has any acumen or not in that department. But one thing that one imagines would do is listen to big business. And there's so many interests. There was a big spat, wasn't there, about some of the big airframe makers and this idea of Canada and the US acting out these problems. But one would imagine that lots of those companies have huge investments in a huge number of employees on both sides of the border. You would imagine Trump would hear from big business on both sides. It's just not tenable to maintain that kind of aggressive front on the issue.
Precisely, but it's just so baffling, because you just wonder, you know, how, where those what that sort of channel of communication is like, basically. Because, you know,
well, is there one?
Well, exactly. Yeah. And I think there is, actually. And I think, you know, we've just, right at the end of the year, a new ambassador finally to Canada was appointed for the US, the first woman to hold that post. She's a businesswoman. She's, you know, obviously kind of fits the PR of the Trump administration of making deals, and, you know, we know how to make money, and, you know, all that, the rest of it. But I think, you know, yes, the lines of communication, I think, are there, but it's, you just never know kind of what the what President Trump wants the message to be. So, you know, in terms of if Canada does, and Mexico do, carry on sort of, you know, being quite difficult about this, as rightly they should be, you know, will he just sort of blow it all and just fit the pattern we've seen over this past year since he took office of just saying one thing that bears very little seemingly logic to actually what is real and right and good.
Thomas, looking at Canada's trade relationships in a global context, you know, I think it was this year that they managed to hash out a trade deal with the EU. And I know that they've also been sending an exploratory delegation over to China to see if it might be possible to come up with a trade deal there. Is there an awareness in Canada that going, you know, as we move further and further into this century, and as maybe the world gets a little bit more multipolar, that they're going to have to look elsewhere anyway?
Absolutely. And it's a real calling card, I think, for this government. It has been this past year, that Canada is a country that's looking out, it's not looking in. And we've seen that sort of in lots of different iterations. So in the middle of the year last year, there was a streamlining of the visa process, for example, which I think cut down the time that these visas were processed for highly skilled, highly educated people from overseas to come to these burgeoning sectors, be it tech or energy, you know, technologies, those kind of things. Sliced it down to 2 weeks, basically. And this appetite to say, look, you know, Canada is a diverse, multicultural place, always has been since its inception. And I think trade fits very firmly into that. Any potential China deal is interesting, because right at the end of the last year, Justin Trudeau made his third trip, I think, to China since he took office as Prime Minister. There was a big anticipation in that trip that there would be a big announcement between both premiers that, you know, official talks on beginning talks, if you like, into a formal sort of trade relationship would begin. The Chinese quashed that and it didn't happen. It was an interesting move on Justin Trudeau's part, because he'd put these caveats, if you like, into the beginning of any talks of workers' rights, of human rights and those kind of things very firmly. And that wasn't something that was acceptable at that time. But that said, Canada really wants to deal with China. Mm. And they've been pursuing this. There was this sense that maybe in the Stephen Harper years, for a decade before Trudeau came in, that really sort of Canada missed a trick with China, that it really had sort of, you know, paid very little heed to this huge possible new market for Canadian products. And the west coast of Canada, for example, has huge Chinese populations. So there was kind of a scratching the head why this momentum hadn't really been there. So it will be an interesting year for trade agreements. The EU deal that you talked about, I mean, that took nearly a decade to sort of come into force, which only happened right at the end of last year. So, you know, these are very long-term things, but I think in terms of the notion that Canada is open for business and that they want to have partnerships, that being part of an international community, both in trade and diplomacy and everything else, is going to be, you know, the image that the Canadian government wants to portray again this year, I think.
Thomas, always great to catch up with you. Thanks for setting the scene for us and flagging up some themes to track in the rest of the year ahead. Very good to have you with us over here in London.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, that is all we have time for this week's Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. Tom, we also have to thank our guests, Fiona Wilson from the Japan Bureau, Thomas Lewis from Toronto and Charles McFarlane from New York.
What a stellar trio. And so interesting to hear the news from on the ground.
I second that, certainly. The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Henry Sheridan.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Goodbye.